From WKAR's Studio S at Michigan State University, this is Current State.
We're a place that would say that we set the bar extraordinarily high and we always got over it.
Autos, agriculture, and tourism all are hitting on full cylinders, and it's a wonderful thing to see.
As ashamed as I am of what went on in that building, I am proud of you.
We want to focus our area and make it something that is walkable, bikeable.
We are a family farm. We live on our land.
Swinging a fly ball, left field, at the fence, and that ball is gone!
I'm Mark Bayshore. Coming up today on Current State, for years, reformers have tried and failed to improve Michigan's system of indigent defense. Ingham County Circuit Judge Thomas Boyd is one change advocate. Hear his take on the long-standing issue. Also, Neighbors in Action checks in with Lansing's Information Technology Empowerment Center. That and more right after NPR News.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, supporting more than 1,100 businesses in the greater Lansing area for more than 110 years. Information at lansingchamber.org.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you've joined us here this morning. I see the Michigan Department of Natural Resources is trying to catch the poacher who shot and killed a bald eagle in a rural area just north of us here in Lansing. I was aware that there were bald eagles on the Grand River near Portland. That's the site where I've been led to believe over the years that it's not uncommon to see bald eagles. Closer to Lansing, I've never been totally certain, to tell you the truth, but the DNR says the shooting of the federally protected bird happened Saturday near Highland Hills Golf Club in DeWitt Township. Bald eagles first received federal protection in 1940 and state protection in 1954. We have an interesting show here for you today. At the top, the Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution makes it clear any citizen accused of a crime will, if necessary, have access to qualified legal representation in court. Many legal professionals think that guarantee has been seriously compromised in Michigan for many years. The state often ranks low in assessments of its system of indigent defense. In recent years, several efforts by the state legislature to strengthen the system have failed, but those efforts do continue. A hearing is scheduled today, Law Day, at the Capitol by the House Criminal Justice Committee. Joining us this morning, Chief Judge of the 55th District Court, Thomas Boyd of Ingham County. He is an advocate for reform of public defense, and he joins us to explain what's wrong with Michigan's system and why it needs to change. Nice to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
For starters, give us a real basic civics lesson here regarding the Sixth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. What does it say?
Well, the Sixth Amendment guarantees you the right to have counsel if you're facing a criminal charge, but prior to the adoption of the 14th Amendment, that was limited to criminal charges by the federal government. With the 14th Amendment applying the original Bill of Rights to the states, that became a right that you had when you faced a state charge.
Mm-hmm.
However, until 1963 in the landmark case Gideon versus Wainwright, the United States Supreme Court hadn't articulated what it means to have a right to have counsel when you face a state charge. And in Gideon versus Wainwright, again, this is 50 years ago in March of 1963, the Supreme Court clearly said if you face a serious criminal charge, which was defined as a felony, then you have a right to an attorney paid for at the state's expense. It's not coincidental, or it is coincidental, that in Michigan, we were just reshaping our Constitution at that time. We had a constitutional convention in 1962.
Yeah.
So that Constitution was in the process of its ratification when Gideon versus Wainwright came out. So the framers of the Constitution of 1963, who I think did an excellent job, didn't have the mandate from the Supreme Court to take care of indigent defense. They just overlapped in time. So ever since the ratification of the Michigan Constitution of 1963, we've sort of been battling about how we would take care of indigent defense. and it has developed since then as a local responsibility. So we have sort of a patchwork quilt across the state of how different systems provide lawyers for poor people accused of crime.
It's generally a county-by-county approach?
It's even more narrow than that, because in Ingham County, we have a county system for felonies, and we have misdemeanor systems in Lansing, East Lansing, and for the balance of the county. Because there's four different courts, we have four different systems. So it's county by county on the felony charges, but on misdemeanor charges, it can be city by city or town by town across the whole state.
Wow. So is that patchwork approach the problem? Does it just need to be coordinated or unified or what?
Well, I think that the problem is that there aren't sufficient systemic safeguards to assure effective assistance of counsel. So I believe, and the bill that will be heard in the House Committee on Criminal Justice today, preserves local control. Because in Michigan, local control, especially in criminal justice, is a very strong element of the way we do things. But what we need are statewide standards that each local system needs to be held accountable for.
Okay. And what on the ground, what isn't working? In theory, is everyone provided with defense? Is it inadequate? Is it here today, gone tomorrow? How does that play out on the ground?
There's a variety of different problems that manifest themselves across the state. But in general, it was characterized by the National Legal Aid and Defenders Association in a report they did in 2008 that speed and economy trump justice, that the rush to push cases through the court system and the desire of local government to save money are more important than the effective assistance of counsel. So, for instance, we have systems where a lawyer is retained for $1,000 or $1,200 a month to take whatever work comes in. So that lawyer has an economic disincentive to file extra motions or to seek trial. They have an economic incentive to plead people guilty because it takes less of their time. So a system that creates economic incentives or disincentives isn't really effective in terms of what the United States Supreme Court would think.
Do other states face this, or does Michigan really stand out here?
Michigan really stands out in terms of some of the extremes, but we're not alone. If this bill passes and Michigan creates a statewide commission to create standards, we would be the 23rd state to do that. Other states have had different structures for the number of years, but it's a battle going on all over. Now, the region Michigan stands out. I'll give you an example. I was lucky enough to be invited by Attorney General Eric Holder to a symposium on the anniversary of Gideon versus Wainwright in March, and there was a panel discussion, and it was the Attorney General Eric Holder, Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan, and former Vice President Walter Mondale, who played a leading role in the Gideon decision in 1963. And they were discussing the problems. And when Attorney General Holder asked Supreme Court Justice Kagan, how bad is it? What's really going on out there in the country that we need to worry about in terms of the effective assistance of counsel?
Mm-hmm.
She told a story of a case that was recently decided by the Supreme Court. And she didn't say the name of the case or where it was from. But the facts of the case were that an individual was accused of attempted murder. And he was offered a reasonable plea offer by the prosecutor. And his court-appointed defense attorney told him, you don't have to take that offer, because everybody knows that if you shoot someone below the waist, you can't be guilty of attempted murder. Now, your listening audience is full of non-lawyers, and they all know that's wrong. But this lawyer gave that advice.
Okay.
Now, Justice Kagan gave this as an example of how bad things are. That's a Detroit case. That was a Wayne County, Michigan, appointed counsel who gave that advice.
Okay.
So we kind of are being held out as laughingstocks in the country about where we are. So are we alone? No. Are we in trouble? Yes.
You and others are asking that a system adhere to the American Bar Association's 10 principles of indigent defense. Tell us why you think that's a good benchmark, and maybe if you could give us an example or two.
Okay. The American Bar Association, a number of years ago, collected the constitutional law from the United States Supreme Court and from the circuit courts around the country to try and spell out what a system providing indigent defense should, what it should look like. And for instance, the first principle is it should be independent from the judiciary. What that means is the judges shouldn't get to pick who the lawyers are.
And why is that important?
Another good example out of Michigan is about a year ago, I was asked to come down and speak to the Wayne County District Court Judges Association. Talk about the work of Governor Snyder had a Indigent Defense Advisory Commission that was working at that time, and I was privileged to be appointed by the governor and serve on that commission. And I was reporting on the work of the commission to some of my colleagues in Wayne County. There's about 25 district court judges in the room, and there was one Wayne County Circuit Court judge there, too, who had presented on a different topic before I spoke. And I talked basically about the ABA 10 principles, including the first principles, independence from the judiciary, creating a system that isn't interlinked with the judges. And when I was done talking, the Wayne County Circuit Court judge raised his hand with a question. And I said, yeah, Judge, what's your question? He said, well, wait a minute. If I don't get to appoint my lawyers, how will I fund my campaign? And as awful as that sounds, he wasn't kidding. And not one of those 25 judges in the room laughed. They all looked at me like, well, that's a good question. Wonder what the answer is.
Wow.
And that's just simple corruption. I mean, these are good people caught in a corrupt system that needs to be fixed.
How big is Wayne County in the larger Michigan problem?
Well, you don't have to be in Wayne County to have a problem. I mean, Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb, I've heard represent about 45% of all criminal cases and about 50% of all capital cases. And capital cases, murder cases, just require a lot of expertise, a lot of time, a lot of resources. So the metro area is a significant piece of this. But in smaller counties, Hillsdale County, St. Joe County, if you're facing a misdemeanor, you may not get a lawyer at all, in spite of the fact that the United States Supreme Court said last year on March 21st in Missouri versus Frye that it's absolutely mandatory that someone facing a charge that might result in jail have a lawyer as soon as they come to court, not just at trial. So there's rural counties that don't have the money to do this, perform this function adequately either. And it's not just a Wayne County problem.
Over the years, I'm led to believe that the funding piece has accounted for an awful lot of the resistance to change. Am I right about that?
I think so. I think that that's an accurate portrayal. Over the 50 years since the Constitution of 63 and since Gideon versus Wainwright was decided, numerous Supreme Court justices, chief justices of the Michigan Supreme Court, numerous governors, numerous state bar presidents have asked for reform. They've impaneled commissions like the one I sat on last year. They've impaneled groups, and they've tried to address this problem. And the ability to fund it effectively has always been the barrier to break it down. But because of the leadership of Governor Snyder this year and last year, I think that the state is beginning to realize that this is an obligation they cannot walk away from. There is some pressure from the United States Department of Justice, too, who's kind of in the shadows lurking with threatening a lawsuit to enforce the Sixth Amendment rights for citizens of Michigan. If the Department of Justice came in and sued Michigan, as they just did Memphis, Tennessee last year, you know, the state might lose control over its spending. And so I think the governor, for good reasons, and other people for maybe less good reasons, are stepping up and saying, let's control our destiny, not let the Department of Justice and a federal judge tell us how this is going to turn out.
We're talking with Judge Thomas Boyd, Chief Judge of the 55th District Court here in Ingham County, about reform of public defense. All of this intractable, seemingly intractable problem continues despite repeated attempts at reform over the years, and some quite recently. You refer to Governor Snyder's IDAC, the final report issued in June of 2012, a bill passed in the House, but it died in the Senate. Can you summarize why these legislative attempts at reform have struck out?
I think that the question you ask is specific. When the Indigent Defense Advisory Commission issued its report in June of 2012, there was enough time through the summer recess to have a bill drafted based upon that report, and Representative Tom McMillan submitted that bill, and as you said, it passed the House by a wide margin with bipartisan support. It really entered the Senate at a time when the election was heated, and after the election, there's just this period of time called lame duck where I don't know that any reasonable citizen would be pleased with how lame duck works, but this item just didn't make the agenda. I don't think that it's fair to say that there was a malice afoot at that point. And so the proponents of that piece of legislation that simply died because the clock ran out in 2012 are the same people that have introduced this legislation in 2013 and the same people that will be this morning in the House promoting this legislation on Law Day.
We've got less than a minute with Judge Boyd. What is the role of public opinion in this? Is there a lack of awareness? Is it apathy? What's in play?
I think it's probably a lack of awareness. I mean, when I talk to groups that are learned and involved in the system and tell them how bad things are with specific examples like I've given you here today, most people are pretty surprised.
Chief Judge of the 55th District Court here in Ingham County, Judge Thomas Boyd, is an advocate for reform of public defense. There is a hearing scheduled today, Law Day, at the Capitol by the House Criminal Justice Committee. Judge Boyd, many thanks.
Thank you very much.
It's Wednesday and time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make the greater Lansing community a better place. This week, we feature Lansing's Information Technology Empowerment Center, or ITEC. ITEC's a nonprofit that offers technology training to children and adults, and here to tell us more about ITEC's work is Kathy Post. She's their K-12 program manager, and joining her is one of ITEC's students, Josh Ambrose. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Kathy, tell us about ITEC and the work that you do. What's it like?
ITEC, we often refer to ourselves as the IT Empowerment Center. We offer learning and strengthening of IT skills for both youth and adults. We do so with our youth programs in very fun and innovative ways. We have classes such as Lego Robotics, where students build a robot and they program it to do different things. We have a game design class, which students, they make their own working video game. So to go into that, there's a lot that they learn in doing that, not only the technology part of it, but there's also creativity, there's storytelling, there's teamwork. They just learn all kinds of things in that.
Is there a lot of demand for what you're offering?
We have been growing. The last summer, in our summer camps, we had 30 summer camps, and we had waiting lists. They were full, and we had waiting lists. So we're finding a real growth in our youth programs.
Do you serve more youth than adults then, or?
I believe that we do, yeah. Our adult program is called Everyday Digital, and it's not as strong on the IT side. It's for people, adults, who need very basic computer skills.
Yeah, I imagine.
And that program was started because there were so many people in our community misplaced in the job market. So, for example, we have a student, a woman who's 59 years old. She worked in manufacturing her whole life, and she lost her job. And she does not have any computer skills at all. She came to our basics class this semester. She's in our basics class, and she did not even know how to turn a computer on. So we work with these people so that they can gain skills and get gainful employment.
Okay. Josh Ambrose, you're a student at ITEC. What have you learned while you've been there?
I have learned how to use programs like Kodu and GameMaker, and we have instructors that are with us each step of the way to help us create our own world, and it's really fun. I mostly go there for entertainment, but I do learn a lot too.
How hard is it? I mean, you're characterizing it as mostly a fun experience, a great way to learn.
Yes, yeah. I do like challenge. It is very challenging. Because computers, telling them what to do is very hard. And making a game, you have to limit all the characters and the world, but you have to not go too far or too little. And it's very interesting, and it's in a class setting, so you can look over at your friend's computer and see what they're doing or ask them for help.
We're just a few feet away from here in the Comm Arts Department at Michigan State, second floor Comm Arts building, from a huge game design center. So I would think you're on the cutting edge here of something. Really, is this something you think about doing professionally, or is it just a fun sidelight for you?
I actually don't think I will choose it as a career. I've thought about it a few times, but I don't think I would like sitting behind a computer all day for work.
Okay. And you're how old, Josh?
I'm 16 years old.
And where do you attend school?
I'm homeschooled.
Homeschooled. Okay.
Yeah.
Kathy, a lot of homeschooled youth in the program?
We have been working with the Lansing Homeschool Group, which is where Joshua is, for we've had three classes for them. We work through partner locations mostly. We hold our classes at places where kids are, like the YMCA and LCC and the Capital Area District Library. But we do special classes for the Lansing homeschoolers, and it's been a great experience. They have really dedicated students who come to every single class.
You've got a pilot math program that you're working on that's in two Lansing schools. Tell us about that.
Yes, that we call that our iMath program. We started just at the end of November of last year,
And it's an after-school program. It meets twice a week for 1 hour after school at Luton Elementary School and at Sheridan Road Elementary School. And we're seeing great success with that. The program we use is interactive. It's a web-based program. It's fun learning. After the kids do a certain number of problems, they get to play a game within the program.
Are these kids playing catch-up, or are these kids what?
Mostly catch-up. We targeted kids who are at a 25 to 75% in math, and the school district helped us to identify the kids who would be good. At Luton School, we had spaces for 30 kids because there are 30 computers in their computer lab, and 63 kids signed up. So we had a waiting list of 33 kids at that school. And we are seeing, there's one student who has gained a whole year in math in 4 months. I'm sure some of it he learned in his class, but he says that coming to iMath, or iTech as they call it, has been tremendous for him.
Do you offer need-based scholarships or some sort of program for parents who want to sign their child up but can't afford it?
For the iMath?
Yeah.
That is no cost to the students.
Okay.
They are students at the school. They just stay after for the extra hour, and they come to iMath, and there's no charge to their families.
Well, do you or any other group offer scholarships to your services, though?
We do through our summer camps, for example. The YMCA does have scholarships. If a student wants to take one of our classes, our summer camps, there are scholarships available if they can afford it.
Okay. Josh, you must have a computer at home,
I
assume.
Yes, I do.
But what you do at iTech just kind of takes it to another level.
Yes.
Is that a safe way to put it?
Yes. Okay. At home, I actually have slow internet, so I can't really download like the Kodu or GameMaker game labs to help me make stuff. So I usually have to go to iTech to use their equipment.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, do you want to grow this? I mean, is there an opportunity to serve more people here?
Absolutely. We do want to grow this.
How are you going to try to do that?
Well, we would like to expand iMath. Right now, we're in the two schools that teach 4th through 6th grade. We'd like to be in all 6 of those schools in the fall. And as far as our other classes, we are fortunate. We keep finding great new partners. The Capital Area District Library is one of our newest partners, where they host our LEGO classes. So we're just looking to grow with partnerships.
Is the school system, is the Lansing School District, I mean, our conversations with them, are they on board?
Very much so.
Okay.
Yes. Our executive director, Kirk Riley, met with the superintendent, and from there, there were meetings with the principals and meetings with different people, and they're very much on board.
So you are you aggressively seeking partners? Is that the key? Is that the catalyst to really growing the program?
For our youth programs like the LEGO and the game design, that's a very key element. The partnerships that are strong for us are partners where there are a lot of kids there who are interested in our classes, and the partner registers them. The partner has a computer lab, and so then we come and we bring our very talented instructors and our LEGO kits in, and we work together to pull these classes off.
And finally, tell our listeners how they can become involved in the work that you do, Kathy.
We are always looking for volunteers. If anyone has interest in teaching computer classes, especially at our adult level, we have what we call upgrades. They're 2-hour free classes on things like finding a job online and setting up your LinkedIn account to help people to find jobs. We're always looking for volunteer instructors for things like that.
Sounds like a great opportunity for a volunteer instructor to actually learn an awful lot, though, too, especially around these younger guys like Josh.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful experience, our instructors always tell us.
Kathy Post is the K-12 Program Manager at the Information Technology Empowerment Center. Josh Ambrose is an iTech student. Thanks to both of you for joining us today, and good luck.
Thank you.
We could always use more nominations, and we know that there are great people and organizations out there that are doing great work, and Current State just doesn't know about them. If you'd like one to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, please send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work that they do. Coming up on Current State, MEDC's Executive Director Michael Finney. Stay close. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Michigan Economic Development Corporation touts itself as the state's marketing arm and lead agency for business, talent and jobs, tourism, and other economic incentives, grants, and overall economic growth. Our next guest serves as its current president and CEO. Michael Finney came to MEDC from a key economic development position as the head of the Ann Arbor Spark. Governor Rick Snyder appointed him in January 2011, and this is the first of hopefully many regular visits with Mike about MEDC and Michigan's larger economic picture. Welcome to Current State.
Well, thanks for having me, Mark.
Being a Lansing show, I have to ask about MEDC's role in the Jackson National Life proposal to expand here in Lansing. Tell us about that.
Well, first of all, it's a great project. It's a great opportunity for the Lansing area, a great opportunity for the state of Michigan. Jackson National is committed to hire approximately 1,000 jobs over the next few years and invest $100 million. So that's a project on a scale of any that we've seen over the last couple of years. So it's great news. MEDC has been working with the company for many months. I think the first conversation I had with them about a potential expansion was in the later part of 2011. And so they've been in the process of assessing growth plans for quite some time, and we're very fortunate that they ultimately decided to make the expansion here in Michigan.
What's the takeaway from a proposal like this from Jackson National? What, if anything, does this say about Michigan?
Well, their CEO, Mr. Wells, indicated that the totality of what Michigan has done over the past couple of years to really become an incredibly business-friendly state. And, you know, a lot of the changes in terms of tax reform and regulatory reinvention, I mean, those are the kinds of things that send a positive message to businesses like Jackson National. And their CEO was pretty candid about that in his comments.
For all of Detroit's challenges, I know there are some encouraging developments. Dan Gilbert's playing a huge role. An important light rail project is on the table. But tell us about ADP and the new jobs they're bringing to Detroit.
Yeah, Detroit is one of those locations that I think is just upside potential that's pretty dramatic. And we're starting to see evidence of that. Projects like what Dan Gilbert has been doing for the past couple years. He's been a major investor. He's acquired, I think, 14 or 15 buildings at last count in downtown Detroit.
And is he the source of a lot of the upside potential, man alone?
Well, you need individuals like him who really make very big bets, very aggressive bets that the city is in recovery. And I think he's making wise bets. And then you start seeing other companies like ADP and others that are looking to come into Detroit and locate. Detroit was identified as one of the top IT and software hotspots in the country. And so when you hear that and you see that, it's more than what Dan Gilbert's doing, but he's obviously a leader in that regard, and it's great to see it happening.
We're led to believe infrastructure is intimately connected to economic development. How closely are you watching the roads and infrastructure debate in the legislature, and how important is that?
Well, it's critically important, and we know that transportation infrastructure in particular is critical to businesses like the ones we have here in the state of Michigan. We make things, and in a state that makes things, and not just cars, but processed foods, furniture, pharmaceuticals, those things need to be transported one way or another, and that typically starts off on a road. And so our ability to have good transportation infrastructure is critically important. We obviously are paying close attention to what's happening through the current legislative process, but most importantly, we support Governor Snyder's executive recommendations. And we just trust that through the budgeting process, there will be a commitment to make some improvements.
You follow the legislature closely enough that you feel good about those prospects?
Well, I don't know that I'm close enough to the budget debate to say where it's going to end up at. But I do trust that our legislature understands the importance of supporting infrastructure, and in this case, roads and bridges in our state.
What is the importance of the North American International Trade Crossing, and where does that stand right now?
Yeah, so the new International Trade Crossing, I'm assuming you're referring to the new bridge that will connect Detroit to Windsor.
Yes.
Yeah, that project is moving along. If you recall, I think a couple weeks ago, we received the presidential permit that was required in order for a crossing to be developed between the United States and other foreign countries. And so that's in place now. And so there is a lot of behind-the-scenes activity that has to happen before the first shovel of dirt is actually moved. But it is proceeding, and we expect that it will continue to move forward.
We're talking with Michael Finney, President and CEO of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. I'm obligated to ask about a story that appeared in MERS yesterday. Nine companies had their MEDC tax credits or incentives revoked in the past year for one reason or another. Now, according to the story, only two of those nine were asked to make good on delinquent back taxes. When asked if that was standard procedure, your colleague Carla Campbell answered pretty much. Why is that?
Yeah, we try and work with the communities. In the case of the incentives that you're referring to, it's about Renaissance zones. You know, those were put in place over many years. And we try and work with the local communities to make an assessment of whether we should pursue a recovery of any benefit that a company may have received. And on the basis of how significant those benefits were and the community's input, we try and make a reasonable decision on whether to pursue it.
The article went on to cite a couple of instances, apparent instances, where poor communication and misreporting did not lead to payment of back taxes. One of them was here in Lansing, the Lansing Tool and Engineering Company and the Western UP Recycling Center. Can you explain that? I mean, I think they're referred to as clawback provisions. Do clawback provisions need to be strengthened by the Treasury Department in our state in situations like this?
Well, it's important that when we are being good stewards with the state's resources, that we try and put in place language and agreements that make it possible for us to protect the state's best interests. And I think every attempt is made to do that, both by the MEDC, the Michigan Strategic Fund, and Treasury. In those cases where there simply is not a resource to go after, and in some cases companies simply go out of business, there's really nothing to go after. So, in those cases, you may see us not making a recommendation to Treasury to pursue it. In other cases, we will. So we really just try and use good judgment based on where a project is at and working with the local community.
If Michigan is reinvented the way the Snyder administration wants it to be, what sectors of the state economy do you think will grow?
Well, we're not trying to pick the winners. We're really trying to be as opportunistic as possible. So we're talking with business leaders and trying to understand where they see growth opportunities. Obviously, you know, the automotive sector is doing reasonably well right now, and we certainly trust that they will, you know, stay very focused and continue doing well. But we see great opportunities for expanded agriculture. In fact, we're working with Jamie Clover Adams in the Department of Agriculture fairly closely because we think there's huge potential for food processing in our state and the export of various foods that are processed in our state. Tourism will continue to be big, and in fact, it's growing, and we're looking to make greater investments in our tourism efforts. So we've got a variety of different places we can go, but we are a state that makes things, and it's important to understand that the potential is there across a number of different sectors, and we trust that we'll continue to do well.
Is a higher health care profile possible in Michigan?
Well, healthcare is one of those where I think the fact that Michigan has had some of the best quality care that you're going to find any place in the country has positioned us to really take advantage of that. The healthcare profession is actually a very big one in our state. The challenge, of course, is figuring out how to convert it into a destination business. And I don't think we have healthcare destination businesses at this point, but there are a number of efforts underway. Over in Oakland County, they have Medical Main Street that they're pushing very aggressively. In the Ann Arbor area, there's some activity underway, and in other pockets of our state. But I don't think that any region has made an aggressive decision to make that their top priority. I think Oakland County is probably the closest that I've seen with their Medical Main Street.
We've been talking with Michael Finney, who is President and Chief Executive Officer of the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. Thanks for the update, Michael. We'll see you again soon.
Thank you, Mark.
Not often recently have we heard of new tax credits, right? Lots more frequently we hear of the elimination of tax credits, but there are exceptions. A State House panel is expected to discuss a bill today that would provide tax credits for student loan payments. The Michigan Competitiveness House Committee plans to debate the measure today. Residents who graduated from one of the state's public or private colleges or universities could claim an income tax credit equal to 50% of certain student loan payments. So there's an exception to every rule, I guess. The stretch of Grand River Avenue and Michigan Avenue from the Capitol Building all the way east to Weberville is this region's busiest corridor. A new plan led by the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission is in the works to transform the corridor with more attractive design, improved rapid transit, and sustainable business and infrastructure improvements. This is still in the early stages of the design phase, and they're calling for the public's help. Starting today and through May 7th, there will be a design charrette open to residents of Clinton, Eaton, and Ingham counties, where feedback and suggestions from the community are not only welcome but essential to the design process. And here to talk about the plans for the Grand River Avenue corridor and the design charrette are a couple of the project's leaders. Sue Pigg is executive director of the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission, and Bill Leonards is the executive director of the National Charrette Institute. Welcome, Bill. Welcome, Sue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sue Pigg, tell us briefly about the larger project. This is a 3-year project for which you received a grant. What is it designed to accomplish, and where do you hope to be in 3 years?
Well, this is one project activity under a 3-year grant that we received to this region from the Housing and Urban Development of the federal government. We're funded to develop a sustainable plan for the Tri-County region. So one of those activities is to focus on this busiest corridor and bring together all the different aspects of our community, the people concerned with transportation, with economic development, with environmental protection, with quality lifestyle, to bring everyone together to talk about what our vision will be going forth to the future for a more sustainable community. And we're going to focus some of those energies of that planning activity over the next week in a new and intensive planning process on this corridor. We'll be able to use this process in the future for other areas in our community, and we'll end up, after the 3-year program, with a much more sustainable long-term vision for where our community can go successfully.
You started out in a really urban part, relatively urban. I mean, it's a main thoroughfare. Is sustainability a bigger issue in the urban areas than it is in the rural areas?
You know, it's interesting that you say we started out in the urban area, because we're actually starting on both ends and throughout our region. One of the reasons we have chosen this corridor to focus this kind of an activity on is because it truly demonstrates for our region the many different kinds of communities and areas that we have in the greater Lansing
okay.
region. We have urban, we have suburban, we have rural, we have small towns and villages. Weberville, Williamston, Williamstown Township, Meridian Township, East Lansing, and Lansing. We have that entire array of different kind of communities across the corridor. And this vision helps us bring together all of the different factors that you consider in planning with all of the different kinds of communities that we have as a region, and to develop a cohesive vision for our entire area that doesn't separate the urban from the suburban as if they were apart, because in our region, we travel right through them together. They're all part of our community.
Okay. Bill Leonards of the National Charrette Institute, tell us about this mysterious word. What is a charrette?
Well, Mark,
thanks for joining us on
charrette
Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore.
It's a week-long, intensive public design workshop, and it's the opportunity for people, anybody who is involved in this corridor, it's 21 miles, whether you live there, work there, do business there, go to school there, take care of people in the hospital there, we want you to get involved in this, because this is going to be very different. Instead of planning over a series of months and having lots of meetings that happen over time, we're going to press all that into 1 week. So the charrette is really, I guess one way to think about it, Mark, is that it's like a combination of a barn raising and a New England town meeting.
Okay.
Where people get to come together and work with a design team. So there's going to be a group of experts who are particularly good at drawing visions. A lot of drawing is going to take place, and drawing is a great way to make sure everyone sees the same idea. But the people of the community are going to be able to be involved in the evolution of a vision that'll be drawn over the course of a week from a kind of a blank slate to a set of alternative ideas to a set of final recommendations. And people are going to be able to be involved in that whole evolution of that plan, working with designers.
Sue Pigg, where and when does this interaction take place?
Well, we're starting off with a kickoff event on Wednesday evening tonight from 6 to 9:30 at the Lansing Center in downtown Lansing. People are invited, the general public, anybody that can come, join us. We'll explain what is charretting and have some tabletop sort of exercises to encourage people to vision. Sunday afternoon, we'll have an open house at this design studio that we've set up in the former Jacobson's Barnes & Noble bookstore building on 333 Michigan Avenue in East Lansing. The designers will be working at tables, drawing and demonstrating and collecting all of the ideas and thoughts. And then on May 7th, Tuesday evening, from 6:30 to 9 at the Hanna Community Center in East Lansing, we'll reveal or unveil the summary of all of those ideas and visions and talk about next steps for our region.
How interesting. And you're emphasizing, Bill Leonards, that you need not be any kind of planning professional to play a role in this thing.
No, absolutely not. We want to hear what people, you know, what's important to them from their place in life. Some people want more, you know, better business. Some people want to get around better on bikes. Some people want to see the water cleaner. There's all kinds of viewpoints, and we want to bring them all together to forge a vision. I did want to add that there'll be a second charrette in the fall, by the way, where we're going to focus in. This charrette is for the vision of the whole corridor. So a helicopter view of all the way along it. And then we're going to identify three main focal areas that we're going to come back and do another charrette in October and zoom in to some focal areas at a real ground level view of the vision.
Now, is this geared to people who drive on Michigan or Grand River, or is this for people in the areas adjacent? I mean, if you live a mile from Grand River in Michigan or Michigan Avenues, is this geared to those people as well?
I think this is geared to anyone in the region that cares about this corridor, whether you shop it, live on it, travel it, go near it, or just observe it as a key component in what makes part of our region. Then you have an interest or a concern in that corridor, and you should participate in the event.
But the grant emphasizes sustainability. What does it mean to create a sustainable corridor? Take us into the details here a little bit deeper, Sue. What does that mean?
Well, one of the primary components of sustainability, which is, you know, in a simple terms, is to create a life for ourselves that we can maintain.
Yes.
And continue. A primary component of that is the involvement of the people that live, work, and want to be in our region. Their participation is critically important to developing a sustainable corridor. So we're seeking everyone's input to make that happen.
Bill, you've been here in the area, visiting in the area at least since February or so. What have you taken away from the Lansing, East Lansing community? What's your take?
What I always tell the people here is that whether they know it or not, the type of thinking and planning and the coordination between the different agencies to make sustainable communities happen is a national model. Michigan is working together in a better way than any place I've seen in this country.
Really?
At the state level, all the way down to the local level.
What are you seeing that isn't happening
elsewhere? Well, the
emphasis elsewhere
on placemaking, that idea that all anybody who's involved with economic redevelopment, how do we get this state back on its feet, is realizing that in order to really keep the brightest people in place, they want to live in really wonderful communities. They want to live in walkable, sustainable communities. And the state, all the way from the governor down, is talking about how can we make sure that our communities are great places to live in order to attract and keep people here in Michigan.
Does anything jump out at either of you in terms of what we're the way we're doing it now that is not clearly not sustainable?
Oh, I'm going to jump on that one. I've been working in planning and in this region for about 25 years, and we have wonderful working relationships and cooperation amongst municipalities at the ground level in our community. But when we do planning by section or topic. We plan for transportation without talking to the economic development professionals. We plan for and encourage business location without considering the environmental impacts. And we can't continue doing that sustainably because they're interrelated. So in the future, we'll be doing more planning that considers all those aspects at the beginning with the plan, instead of creating a transportation plan that has the road going through quickly and smoothly and trees on either side. We're going to talk to the business owners and make sure that those trees aren't blocking the front windows and preventing them from increasing their business sales. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll be talking to the business locators about the environmental impacts, potential environmental impacts of their construction before they build it and argue about what happened. So in the future, planning will integrate these different aspects, and one of those components is also the viewpoints, perspectives, and understandings of the people that live and work in the community. It won't be done by technicians, and the charrette process focuses on using those people as part of the planning process at the beginning.
How long, Bill Leonards, how long have you been doing what you're doing here with the Charrette Institute?
Close to 30 years.
Okay. Is sustainability really been the defining change in terms of what you've seen?
Well, sustainability is the latest light bulb that's gone on for people, realizing how are we going to solve our problems, our big problems. And we're beginning to realize, and this is something we've done with the Charrette Institute for a long time, is to work together. The only way to solve our problems is to work together. And sustainability is a natural outgrowth of people sitting around the table, as she says, transportation, economics, environmental, everybody, you know, planning, everybody seeing each other's viewpoints and coming up with a plan that works for all the different viewpoints in sustainability.
This sounds like just a fascinating process, and sounds like a unique opportunity for everybody to bring their voice to the table, their ideas to the table.
So we have a website.
Okay, tell us about it.
migrand-charrette, charrette.com, migrandcharrette.com.
Very good.
You can find out all about this in detail there and follow us.
Sue Pigg is the Executive Director of the Tri-County Regional Planning Commission, and Bill Leonards is the Executive Director of the National Charrette Institute. Thanks to both of you for joining us today to talk about reimagining the Grand River Avenue Corridor.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you, Mark.